Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our teleseminar on developing the emotional resources of your students. Thank you, everyone, for joining. We have all the lines muted right now, except for mine and Jim's, because we are expecting a big crowd today, and this way it helps with everyone's listening pleasure. Jim's going to talk today about the significance and impact emotional resources exert on the decision-making processes of students, parents, faculty, and staff members. He's going to talk some about anger management techniques, emotional safety, and the role of mutual respect. During the call, if you think of questions, please just email us at questions@ahaprocess.com, and I will pose those to Jim when we get to our Q&A time. I know everyone's time is valuable and limited, so I'll get right to introducing our speaker today. Jim Littlejohn of Columbia, South Carolina, has been a professional educator since 1976. He taught the middle school, high school, and graduate school level and served as department chair, athletic director, and coach. He served 2 years as teacher in residence for the South Carolina Center for Teacher Recruitment, where he served as professional development specialist. He's currently the president of PEACE, Peace Skills, Inc., and has been providing training and consulting in the area of conflict and anger management, classroom management, peer mediation, interpersonal relations, brain-based learning, and school crisis management. Jim was Lexington Richland District 5 Teacher of the Year, an outstanding young educator by the local in South Carolina JCs, and the South Carolina governor named him a hero for children. What a fabulous accolade. It would be, if you would like more information on what Jim is talking about today, please just email us or call us. Also, Jim is available for consulting and workshops at your school on this and other topics. So without further ado, Jim, can you get started on this amazing topic?
Oh, thank you, Stephanie. I guess the first thing I have to realize is, after I hear that introduction, I must be a person still looking for work. So if you have something out there, bring it on. I'm looking. That sounds good. Well, we're going to talk about the emotional resources. Now, it's kind of a challenge to make a phone conference interactive. I mean, I do my best to do that. But before we get into anything, here's what I'd like you guys to think about. Put inside your head, or if you got a piece of paper, put this on a piece of paper. Identify a student or a coworker who you work with who has some, what we like to call, anger issues. So think about that. Kind of place that student again, who calls a coworker on paper, or inside your head. And then what I want you to do as we go throughout this session, so just kind of reference back to that person. See if things we're talking about as a whole true for this particular individual. All right, well, let me kind of get into a definition of what emotional resources are. And as you're familiar with that, we can change work on frameworks to understand the poverty. It is one of the 9 resources. And the concept is entitled being able to choose and control emotional responses, particularly to negative situations, without engaging in self-destructive behavior. Now, that to me is the key point, without engaging in self-destructive behavior. And this is an internal resource that shows itself stamina, perseverance, and the choices. So that's kind of what we're going to look at. That's our working definition for emotional resources. And what emotional resources do is they require a person to be able to do these 3 things. First, is to identify the choices, consequences, and parameters of the situation that they are in. And that comes in 2 forms. You have your internal boundaries and you have external boundaries, and we'll define that a little bit further. The second requirement is that you need to be able to identify some coping strategies. How are we going to deal with the issues that are in front of us? And third is, how am I going to adjust and plan for future or recurring events? Just because something happened, visual border that provides for physical safety of all the folks involved, whether it be a school building, a classroom, or an entire district office, or in the corporate world, this is your headquarters, this is your physical building that you work in, and then also your office. And the two external boundaries or external borders are that there is a clear structure and a clear and consistent process. And the key word there is consistent. Because a lot of times what happens is people will choose how they're going to deal with a particular situation. And if there's no consistency there with the end result, that creates a lot of problems. So again, external boundaries are really those established rules and procedures that come and speak in. For school folks that are online with a district, your school and your classroom, or our business folks that might be working at the corporate headquarters, a physical building that you work in, and your individual office. The second of those two borders is what I'm going to call your internal border, or your internal boundary. And that basically are an emotional border that provides you personal safety. And these typically have consequences for the choices that are made. And the way you can kind of look at this and examine these internal boundaries is to think of it from these four characteristics. Your internal boundaries include your values. What's important to you? Are you someone who thinks honestly is the best policy in the world? Or do you kind of look at it like, well, yeah, I'll be honest, expecting certain situations. So you have values and whatever your important values are. Or what are the critical core values that you see for that other adult that you're thinking about? What do they have? Second part is your needs. Are your needs being met? You know, emotional needs are very critical for your goal. You're constantly talking about that in the book Emotional Intelligence, working with emotional intelligence, talking about how critical and important. The second part, again, that your values and needs is going to be your personal limitations. In other words, what are the things that you consider to be critically important? Someone is in a conflict situation with you, where are you going to draw the line? What is that emotional line that you will not draw? So in a conflict situation, you basically have these four things that are always taking place. Values, your needs, your personal limitations, and those emotional lines that we won't cross. And here's kind of how those internal boundaries all come about. You want to think about your emotions, all right? When we talk about emotions, emotions are a good thing. Emotions come from your thoughts. But what you think about something is going to determine what your emotions are. The next part of that is you begin to think through your own thoughts. So I cannot make you think any differently than what you want to think. You control your thoughts. The third part of that is you create your feelings from your thoughts. Therefore, you control your feelings. So it's easy for Jim to sit on the phone and say, no one can make you angry. You choose to become angry. And that means the day is more challenging to do. But that is, in essence, what's going on here. That's the China of this wonderful adage. They say, control your emotions, or they will control you. And that is so true. That is so true. And as we look at these emotional rituals, one of the things that tends to come up is what we'll call a trigger. And the trigger is the thing that really, really upsets you. It can be verbal, or it can be non-verbal. And this is what leads to the confrontation. So I'm going to give you a second to think about this. That student or coworker that you put down, I'm just saying that you haven't said it in. Think of something that they do, that just makes you break. A behavior that they have that just drives the wall. Alright? Now, you have that in place. Here's what I want you to do. Now I'm going to have a go through the next couple of steps. When you begin to get angry, okay, there's an escalating factor. What you have first is your trigger. Again, that trigger is the thing that you are, whatever that behavior has to do. The second thing that happens is you now begin to think about that. Okay? What just happened? Was that intentional? Or why did this take place? What is the situation? The third thing that happens are your feelings. Okay? So you think, want to think of a ladder. The first rung of the ladder is to climb that ladder in escalation. The first rung of the ladder is the trigger. You're going to get to set you off. Second part of that is going to be your thoughts about that. Third part will be your feelings. The fourth part is going to be your behavior. And the fifth is going to be the consequences, the result of the choice that you made with whatever else came to happen. Now, here's how that works in the real world. Typically, especially in a school environment, what happens is you begin to deal with it at the behavior level, which means it messed up, or in this case, maybe everybody messed up. You're already upset. You're going to deal with your behavior, and then there'll be a consequence for that choice of behavior. Well, the problem is, behavior is already a good example. What we want to try to do is to get to it after we recognize the trigger, and before it gets into our thoughts, and before you develop our feelings. So another way to kind of think about that is whatever that triggering event was, it took place inside your head, that whatever that trigger is, when that happens, how do you deal with it? What's the way that you deal with it right now? A couple of seconds to think about that. All right. The third part, and if I were working with students, I'd have them actually fill out this chart. We're looking at the first part of the chart would be, what are the triggers? What are the things that bother me? Second part of the chart would be, say, when this behavior happens, what do I do about it? Now, the third part, again, you're going to have to do this internally. What's the physical response? In other words, when you get angry, where do you feel it? Where do you sense it? I used to tell my students all the time that, here's how you know when a little guy gets angry. I become the original redhead. My face turns red, my neck turns red. And that is your clue that the better kind of change your behavior because it will be a better consequence of what happens next to that. And of course, what I would ask them to do is to kind of let me know what bothers them and how they respond to it. Because we all have different physical responses to our anger. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. It's a normal emotion. It's what you do with it that creates the problem. So again, if we're looking at the trigger chart versus trigger, secondly, how do I deal with that particular trigger in that patient? Third is the physical response. The fourth thing would be, okay, what are the results of my intervention? What happened as a result of the conflict? And then finally, the fifth part of that chart would be, okay, is my approach effective? Did it change the behavior? Did it end the behavior? And will it not be occur again? If all of that is working well, then what you do is probably good. If not, that's when you can start examining what's going on. So here's another way to think about this whole boundary escalation. Again, you have the triggering event, whatever that was that set the person off. Okay? And then inside your head, you are kind of processing what you're observing, what you're seeing. And what you're doing is you're now examining the food for value, through your personal thoughts, your expectations of that particular individual, and by that I mean most conflicts that we have with the people who we care about most are usually the more intense, and many times that's because we have higher expectations for them, and we assume that they should know better. The kind of problem is you have to have that conversation ahead of time before you can really be sure what those expectations are. So you have the values, the thoughts, the expectations. The next will be experience. How experienced are you in dealing with conflict or dealing with anger? If I'm an elementary school student, I have very limited experience in dealing with anger. And by the way, my best teachers have been the adults during my life, which typically means parents or grandparents or guardians. So after you factor in your personal experience, the next concept is your attitude. And your attitude can be, I don't like this person, I never like this person, therefore you're going to look at them from a different perspective as opposed to, you know what, you're just having a bad day. And then the last part of it, individually understanding what's going on and watching the truth again, is your vocabulary. And a lot of folks say to me, well, Jim, I don't Tom's really mad. Very seldom even does that say, well, when it's get a little bit disturbed. No, we go to mad, but really mad. And then if I don't have any words to describe it, I can't find where I am along that continuum from mad, but to really mad. And so again, what happens? That's the sure of that. Your individual thought process, then comes your feeling. One more time, like this. You have the event or the trigger. Your reaction to that event or trigger is primarily not based on your belief. There are six different individual characteristics I described. Now, as you're going through the characteristics, the next concept is this true? Are they doing this true? What parts are true? And so on. And then again, I'm the feeling followed by the behavior. But typically what we do in the world of work, what we do in school business, is we deal with behavior, not the benefit, not the escalation. Right? Now, let me give you another example of this. Let's just say you've been in a conflict with someone who you care about, usually, and you've had a little verbal exchange, and you're both pretty confused about this verbal exchange. And what happens is you say you're going to go to your separate room, you're going to walk into the other room, and the person you're arguing is going to walk into the other room. And as you walk further away from the scene of the crime, so to speak, stop and pose the question, say, ooh, I wish I hadn't said that. Ooh, why didn't I think about saying that? Well, here's the reason why you haven't gone ahead to stop and say. When you are at the critical element, and you have what we call crisis mode, your anger, your ability to think has an inverse relationship. The angrier you are, the less likely you are to think critically. The best way to do that is either on the way up, which means we're seeing the trigger is taking place. I'm going to look at it and say, okay, here's what I need to do, this is what I should be doing, this is all there. Or if you are able to deal with it then, and the second best time is when you're on the way down and you're de-escalating the conflict. But there's no way that you can have a meaningful conversation when you're at the heightened level of your anxiety and your anger down because the brain is too busy to handle the thing. Or they're saying, why are the children not sure of that? Okay? Now, there's a gentleman named Dr. Robert Smith, who wrote a book called The Mindset of the Effective Educator. And there are two very important concepts that he talks about. I think they're so germane to our conversation today. And here's what the doctor wrote, that addressing the social emotional needs of a student is not an extra curriculum activity. In other words, it should be part of everything we do, because students are not going to be able to learn effectively if they're already angry or if there's other things getting away from the next learning. The second thing, as Dr. Brooks talked about, because I just think it's important, is that empathy is one of the most important skills of an effective teacher. And when I talk about a teacher, that is anyone who's working with young teachers. Third thing that he talked about is educators have a lifelong impact on students, on the development of disabilities. And why I think that's so important, because many, many times, across the field, and as I travel around the country, I try my best to find kids when I get a chance. And I always ask them who is the best teacher and who is the worst teacher that they've ever had. And they will give me great details on both, by the way, their anxiety levels are something as well when they talk about the worst teacher. So they understand what's going on. Now, the next piece that we want to look at is questions to assess emotional resources. Again, the framework that Ruby has spelled what the emotional resources are, and another book that got out called The Under-Resourced Learner, there she really details some questions to assess emotional resources. So, just I want you to read the question, pause a little bit, and I want you to think whether or not the student that you've identified or whether or not the adult you identified has these resources. It's kind of a yes or no. You and I just keep kind of a tally of things. Here's the first question I want you to assess emotional resources. Number one, controls impulsivity most of the time. In other words, they can stay on a path. They don't jump from one thing to the next. Second, some financial behavior and excitement. In other words, they know what's going to get to the future, they know what's going to get to the dollar, and they look excited to that. The third one is controlled anger. Again, that simply means that they're able to recognize when they're getting angry and deal with it effectively. The fourth one is have positive self-talk. In other words, they can talk their way through a difficult situation. They think they can. Either way, they're going to be correct. The fifth one, they see the relationship between choice and consequence. That is critically important. The next one, they resolve a problem with words. In other words, they can talk their way through a difficult situation, and they do not really have very little issue with the first and second. really learn how to develop coping skills? Have they learned how to deal with anger in such a way? And if they haven't, they can be inconsistent when they want, you can have high expectations, you can say, yes, you can do this, you can control this. But if you don't give them the tools to make that happen, that creates a real problem for them. Now, Grant East has a wonderful quote. And what Grant says is, rules without relationship breed rebellion. Rules without relationship breed rebellion. If you don't look too far, at least this world is a different place. The other part of mutual respect that's so critically important for it to exist, you really have to be three more components there. There has to be structure, there has to be consequence, and there has to be choice. And structure is, to go back to one of the first things we talked about today, those external parameters and then the internal boundaries. That's your structure. Your external parameters, again, are all the class rules, all your classroom procedures that you use effectively. Again, the key word to use them effectively is consistency. The second part that allows your mutual respect to exist is the consequence. And the consequence is what happens when that structure is not honored. Now, here's the thing that drives many folks crazy. One size doesn't fit all. The same consequence does not necessarily have to be applied to every child every single time. What you want to find is a consequence that will have meaning to that particular child. And how you go about doing that is obviously through the relationship that you develop and realize very quickly what they can and can't do. The third part of that, that structure of your parameters, what things are on that job, that's a consequence. What can happen when that structure is not honored. And then the third part is the choice. And the choice is that individual decision that we make on how we're going to respond to an individual, or how that particular individual is going to respond to the parameters and boundaries that are established. And so I want you to kind of think about this for a minute. How is mutual respect demonstrated in each of your external boundaries in your place of work? How is mutual respect demonstrated in your district? How is it demonstrated in your school building? And then how is it demonstrated in the classroom? And if mutual respect isn't congruent throughout all three, there are going to be problems. And the same holds true with your non-school environment. You're in the corporate headquarters, or again, the building that you might work in, and then your individual office. So all these things are critically important to understand that mutual respect isn't just about what some folks say is the golden rule. So sometimes the golden rule is viewed as the golden rule. And that could be the power structure. When you have the power structure in charge, without mutual respect, again, as we so eloquently said, rules without relationship breed rebellion. Now, here's a kind of a checklist that we like to use when students look for determining mutual respect. And if you were to sit across from the students and you were to ask them these questions, how do you think they would respond to that? So these are the questions. These, by the way, were developed by students to kind of assess whether or not they thought their teacher cared about them, which is what empathy is all about. Okay, here's the first question. Teacher calls the student by name. Says, hey, you. Teacher uses courtesy, such as please, thank you, etc. The students in turn use courtesies with each other and with teacher. The teacher calls on all students, not just the school you, not just the teacher with you. Teacher gets into proximity, that is within an arm's reach of all students, as often as possible. Now one of the critical elements in looking at that is you don't want to use proximity as a hovering technique. So here's what will tend to happen. Here's a strategy that you can use with students or coworkers. If you give a student or a coworker a directive, I'd like to do this. Once you you've given that directive, don't hover over them until they comply. Give them a chance to comply. Get out of their space. Move somewhere else. By the way, if you're a passionate teacher, when you're thinking about this, what that will tend to do is allow you to give the directive, move out of the way, because here's what's going to happen in the classroom. All the other kids are going to wait to see what happens. You can see that the kids are just getting corrected to. But if you give the directive and move out of the way, they will follow your eyes to wherever you go and wherever your body happens to move. And so what that does is it gives the person an opportunity to comply. If they don't comply, give you a breath, and that creates a consequence. But there's too many times I've seen teachers hover over kids waiting for that response, and all that tends to do is just escalate the situation. Proximity is a good tool, but the concept I like to share with groups is I call it deliver and run. Deliver the message and run out of the way. Get out of the way to get time to respond. All right, we're going back to that. Here's the next couple ideas. Teach your group students up to yours. Basically, what you're doing with your group outdoor is you're assessing their feelings. For example, if you have kids who are constantly fist bumping each other or high-fiving or low-fiving each other, and the first time they don't do that, that kind of gives you a context for that feeling. Something wrong here. And so what I would suggest you do is just ask the kid or ask the other person, say, hey, are you okay? Now, listen carefully to this part. It doesn't matter if they don't respond to you. Okay? What I'm saying is that you have delivered the message that lets them know you care. Don't have to keep begging and pleading, come on, tell me to live on. Just give them the message. If they want to tell you at that time, that'll be fine. Later on in the morning, or later on in the class, when they're doing something else, you might tell you the question again. But no more than two times. Sometimes you're just trying to get them to set and have a feeling. If they talk to you, that's good. If they don't, at least they know you care. The next one, teacher smiles at students. I don't know how many of you in your undergraduate programs were told that don't smile for the first 9 weeks or the first semester. And that's just crazy. You may be the first adult that these kids come in contact with that actually does smile. Okay? So again, smile is a good thing. The classroom, the next step, what Sue said, plus the term neutral space, the classroom has a business-like atmosphere. Students are given tools to assess or evaluate their own work, and that takes it to a different level. So it's something that you really look at. Student-generated questions are used as a part of instruction. So that does it. Let you know what they do or don't know. And then the last one is students may ask for extra help from the teacher. And that's always good. Okay, so again, just a way to kind of check to whether or not kids are getting okay, they can give you mutual respect from the teacher. Now, part of that mutual respect also are communication skills. One of the kind of probably things that require a little bit, just some ideas on effective communication. One of the things that can decrease escalation, begins to reduce escalation, and also makes the difference to turn out better. When we talk about the words we're using, very important to know the intent of the words you're going to use. What is the purpose? What is the purpose of the words? And make sure they're not looking at them from one perspective, they're looking at the other perspective. And that's what formal intention is, just a critical important context. The thing I think is most important in communication is to know that people want two things. They want to be understood, and they want to be valued. They want to be understood, and they want to be valued. And then, what we call reflective listening. And what reflective listening basically is checking for understanding and making sure that you and the other person are really understanding from the same perspective. And you're clarifying their intent. Of course, the other part of that is what are good active listeners. And we're all pretty familiar with what good active listeners are. But just in case, what they're doing quickly, like active listening skills, there's a significant difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is biological. Listening is intentional. If someone has a hearing difficulty, that could be biological issue to maintaining eye contact. So the eye contact is important because what eye contact does is you have to be careful that you don't use it in a negative way. There are certain cultures that define the government, which was it. Certain cultures to look at, whole issue around, look at me when I'm talking to you. Look at me. Look at you when you're talking to me. Those kinds of things. That creates a real anxiety problem. So be careful of that. Okay? Alright? Next, your body position. You know, don't get in someone's face. Make sure you give enough room. Be open and relaxed. It's very tough to have a conversation if you're already anxiety. And then encourage your speakers in both verbal and nonverbal responses. If you want to put an end to communication, and I hope you don't, there are some absolute guarantees to put an end to communication. One is the idea of interrupting. Anytime you interrupt someone, basically what you're telling them is what you have to say is more important than what they have to say. Ignoring. We've all been ignored and we know how much of a big problem that is. Sarcasm. Now, for some of my secondary colleagues out there, you think this is a tool of success. We had a lot of time I gave the personal story and how I learned not to deal with sarcasm and use it in classes. But that was a slicer and dicer when I first started in that. I learned a valuable lesson. But sarcasm, you're going to use it, but you need to be able to let students use it back to you. That's where the problem comes about. Insulting and calling is pretty obvious. Stereotyping. That's another way to avoid communication. Judging, or determining what they are and who they are, and so on. Blaming. Here's my favorite one. Stating opinions as fact. The only fact is that's your opinion. Okay? So again, you have all these different kinds of communication styles and communication issues that create a problem. So I want you to go back and think again for a minute or so about the student or the colleague you're working with. What kind of communication issues do they have? I'll just pause on this degree. All right. Now, I'm going to give you another way to look at this. Concept comes from Stephen Covey. And what Stephen Covey has done is he's taken this idea of what he calls an emotional bank account. And as we all know, in the bank account, you've got two kinds of things you can use. You either deposit or you can withdraw. And here's what Covey says an emotional deposit is. Emotional deposit is emotional resources you demonstrate through practice and or provide to others. In other words, these are things you give to others, okay? And here's the example to you. First one says, seeking first to understand. A deposit is when you look at someone who's in conflict and you try to understand how things are going from their perspective. The second of these deposits, we call it keeping promises. In other words, if I say I'm going to do something, I need to do my best to make sure that happens. If I can't, I need to be honest and upfront to say, I don't know if I can do this. That's a deposit. Third deposit is kind of addressed with all names. Kindnesses and courtesies. Very seldom go wrong with kindness and courtesy. Now it has to be sincere. Don't be sarcastic with it. Clarifying expectations. Now here's an interesting one. We call this loyalty to the absent. What that basically means is you are not going to talk about someone who is not in the presence of you. We're not going to gossip. We're not going to talk about people behind their back. That's what we refer to when it says loyalty to the absent. Another deposit would be apology. Another deposit would be open to feedback. So again, the seven that we talked about is speaking first to understand. Second, keeping promises. The third is kindnesses and courtesies. Fourth is clarifying expectations. The fifth is loyalty to the absent, not talking about the other absent. Sixth is apologies and seven is open to feedback. Those are the deposits. You can do that. You will truly give yourself an opportunity to show that you really are demonstrating strong emotional resource. Withdrawals of emotional resources take away from others or destroy your actions or words. Okay, and those are the things that will change to lead to absolute escalation of a conflict. Okay? And the withdrawals would include pretty much the opposite of everything we talked about. Seeking her to be understood. In other words, your understanding, theirs trying to understand you, is critically more important than you understanding them. Breaking promises, unkindnesses, and lack of courtesy. Violating expectations, and many times that comes about as a result of inconsistency. Disloyalty, that again is talking about someone behind their back. Another emotional bank account withdrawal would be pride, conceit, and arrogance. And sometimes if that comes from the head of the organization, that filters down throughout. And another way to look at that for some could be bullying. And last but not least of the withdrawal would be rejecting feedback. In other words, I don't want to hear anything that anybody has to say. So that's Covey's interpretation of the emotional resources. Now, I wanted to also give you some ideas of things that you can do. And so here's the first one. We'll talk about what does an administrator or teacher do to create emotional resources. Here's some strategies. One. Take opportunities during the day to just check in with kids. Again, it's not about finding out every detail about their life, but just letting them know, hey, we're here, we care about you, how's it going? You know, if you've seen them do something outside of school that's a positive, whether it be athletics or sports or music or anything, if you see them in the work environment, they want to say, hey, I'm working with four really, really hard workers, those kinds of positive feedback. Another strategy is do not try to fix the problem. Help them help themselves. Give them some tools for the most success they will have when they fix it themselves. Another way to create emotional resources is accept the feelings of kids. Acknowledge, hey, this is a challenge. This is difficult. I'll tell you what, being in high school is a tough place to be. Being in middle school is even tougher because you're going through all the growth. You've got all these issues about am I accepted or not accepted. Another strategy, again, is to use that adult voice. The consequences need to be identified. Choices need to be identified in a consistent manner. And again, you can also help problem solving and examining options. Stephanie, I know you said we need to take a pause here after 45 minutes, and that's what I have right now to pose any questions. So give me an idea of what we do next.
Okay. We do have one quick question, and that is that our listener wanted you to reiterate with the second question to access emotional resources, what that is.
Okay. Let me backtrack here. The second one was to plan for behavior and assignments. In other words, I know how to teach from upsetting another kid. I know how to teach from upsetting the teacher or in the work environment. I know what the pet peeves are, and I'm not going to try to take them.
But I'll just reiterate for everyone listening, if you've got any other questions for Jim, please send them to questions@ahaprocess.com. So Jim, that's what I've got at this point. If you've got a few more, if you've got a little more information with us, you can go ahead and then touch base again with me and I'll see if any more have come in.
Okay, absolutely. Here's the next piece I wanted to add to this. And this comes from the work of Daniel Goleman and both his books, The Emotional Intelligence, or Emotional Intelligence was the first book he wrote, and then his follow-up book was Working with Emotional Intelligence. And by the way, what he says in both these books is that one of the skills that employers are looking for are these emotional intelligence. Not so much all of the other stuff that is necessary to be successful in the workplace, but how do we learn to get along? So what he does is he's identified two different kind of competencies. Here's the first one. He calls the first one personal competencies. And his definition is this. These competencies, determine how we manage ourselves. So the first part is, how do I manage myself? And for those of us who work with kids in the classroom, that is critical importance. We can get them to understand themselves and be more effective in controlling themselves. That's the possible. Here's the three competencies under that personal competence that he talks about. The first one is self-awareness. And what he does, he defines it as emotional awareness, recognizing one's emotions and their effects. The second one is accurate self-assessment, knowing one's strengths and limits. That goes back to what I said earlier. I think I can, or no, I can't. Do I know my limitations, and am I willing to stretch beyond my limitations? And I will stretch beyond my limitations if there is mutual respect. And in that classroom, it's safe for me to mess up. It's safe for me to be wrong. In the work environment, it's safe for me to try something different. Okay? First thing is self-confidence, a strong sense of one's self-worth and capability. The second category under personal competence that Goldman talks about is self-regulation, and he defines that as managing one's internal space, impulses, and resources. Okay? We talked about this before. Self-control, keeping the stress of emotions and impulses in check. Again, what have you skills to do that? Trustworthiness. Do I have a sense of honesty and integrity? And for many folks, that's one of those emotional lines that we feel about crossing. Now, once someone has been dishonest to us, it's very difficult for us to bring that back in the fold. And that's a challenging thing for us. Adaptability. Can I deal with change? Change can be very frustrating, whether it's through a daily routine, major changes, okay? And innovation, I talked about as part of self-regulation. Am I able to deal with novel approaches and ideas? And then the third part of personal competence that he talks about in motivation is emotional tendencies that guide and facilitate reaching goals. Can I meet a standard of excellence? Can I align myself with the goals of the group or the organization? In other words, for the school, like school folks, you know, do I know how to follow the rules? Can I follow the rules? And the other one he talks about is optimism, persistence in pursuing goals despite the obstacles and the setbacks. And for those of you who are familiar with the framework to understand the positive, this is critically important. We sometimes, through the organization, we call that a future story. How will I get beyond what limitations there are in front of me? How do I get beyond survival mode? Where I'm taking care of myself and I have a plan for future events. So that's the first is really what he calls the personal competency. The other two are what he calls social competency. And basically what these are dealing with is relationships. And that, again, is what is the critical element in school. If there are no relationships, there will be very little academic success, unless I'm already a talented student, I will do it in spite of what's going on. Well, the first of the two social competencies that we talked about is empathy. And empathy is awareness of others' feelings, needs, and concerns. And when he talks about that, he talks about understanding others, their feelings, their perspectives, taking an active interest in their concerns. Empathy and developing others, sensing others' development needs, bolstering their ability. That's the thing, what we're really doing when we're checking them at the door. We're kind of looking at them and saying, hey, I recognize there's a problem. Now, if you want to talk about it, I'm here. If not, I'm still here for you when you're ready to talk. Service orientation. How do I take care of and meet the future needs of my students, of my colleagues that I work with, and so on? Here's one that's a challenge for all of us. And he calls it leveraging diversity, cultivating opportunities for different kinds of people. You know, how do we learn more about our students? If they don't look like us, if they don't live in the same place we do, how do we understand that? So I think that's critical and important. That's part of the heart and soul of the framework, too. And political awareness, whether it be government, what emotion is at use versus leading the group's emotional current and power relationships. And for those of us in the school business, we all know that sometimes it's two or three kids in the classroom that can wreak havoc on the rest because they have that power. They have that sense of control. So we need to make sure that you can deal with that effectively. And the second part of the social competence is we call it social skills. And that's influence. And I'm sure he's referring to positive influence. Communication, we talk about that. Conflict management, we talk about that. Leadership. And do I have to be a overt leader? Everybody can see what's going on. Verbal, or can I be a covert leader and get things done? Can I be a change catalyst in another category? Building bonds, nurturing relationships. And the last two we talked about is collaboration, cooperation, working with others towards that shared goal. And then last but not least, team capability, creating group synergy, pursuing collective goals. In other words, teamwork. Now, if anyone else has any more questions, and we can kind of wrap it up with one last idea.
Jim, I don't have any questions at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, then we will jump into the last feature. This is a strategy I thought I'd share with you at the end, and it comes from a woman named Adele Faber. She wrote an old book, but it's still a good book. It's called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, and Listen So Kids Will Talk. And one of the acronyms that she uses in there, which I think is a great tool for dealing with conflict and anger and frustration from young people. By the way, it also works with adults. And here's the acronym. It's spelled H-E-A-T. And she calls it Take the Heat. H-E-A-T. And basically, here's what each of the four acronyms mean. The H stands for hear. And the idea is, what I hear you saying, you're developing your communication skills, you're looking at reflective listening, you're kind of getting the sense of, so here's the problem, I'm listening to you explain the problem from your perspective. The E in peace is empathize. And it's an interesting way she describes it. I'm just going to read it so that it sounds better, right? If I were in your situation, I would also be upset. You're obviously upset, and I understand why you're upset. Empathy, from her perspective, means that you can understand how they might feel. Now, I caution you in this, and when I do live presentations in this, I always talk about don't confuse being empathetic with being sympathetic. Because if you confuse empathetic and sympathetic, it winds up being pathetic. You cannot say you've been in someone's shoes if you haven't. And a best example is if I'm talking to you and I know that a child's parents have gone through a divorce, and I say to them, well, I know how you feel. And they say to you, oh, your parents divorced, and you say, well, no, they've never been divorced. You've just lost credibility. And so you have to be careful. Don't confuse empathy. You're in their shoes for being sympathetic. But what her statement is, if I were in your situation, I think that's a powerful way to use empathy. The A is apologize. So we got A to hear, B is empathize, and A is apologize. And let me say this up front before I give you her definition. Apologize doesn't mean you're apologizing for anything. What the apology is, shows like this. She says, I'm really sorry that this happened to you. I can't keep back with this guy, but perhaps I can. In other words, she's saying, you know what? I'm sorry that did happen to you, but there's still a consequence to pay. And then finally, the T in T is to take action. And this is when you can either let them have ownership, or let them try to figure out a successful way to deal with it, or you can give them tools to help address that. All right, and I know our time is just about up, but I would like to end with this quote from former President Kennedy. And before I do that, I want to thank you guys for giving up your time. I hope I gave you a couple of nuggets. You've got the email to send us some more questions, and I'll be glad to try to respond to those as soon as I can. But I appreciate you guys giving up your time today. I hope wherever you are, it's been a good day, and the rest of the week will works well for you. But here's the last quote. John F. Kennedy said this: our task is not to fix blame for the past, but to fix the course for the future. And any time you deal with conflict or anger or emotional resources, that's really what we're doing. Once the event has happened, you can't undo the event. We don't get anything wrong. What we can do is move forward. If we hadn't looked at that triggering event and kind of de-escalated before we got there, if we're in the heart, beating the battle of it, then what we want to do when it's over, it's over. We want to deal with the issue, we want to try to resolve it, and move forward with it. So again, I thank you all so much for hanging with us. Stephanie, thanks for being a great facilitator, and I'll hang on if folks have some more questions.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. This was really terrific. I know I took all kinds of notes, and I'm sure that everybody else got a lot out of it, too. As Jim said, if anyone has any questions that they think of after, I know lots of times I, 20 minutes later, I'll be like, that's what I wanted to ask him. So if that happens to you, please do go ahead and email us at questions@ahaprocess.com. I will forward those to Jim, and we'll get an answer for you. Thank you so much, Jim. This was terrific. I hope everyone enjoyed spending their lunch hour with us, and we will be in touch with more teleseminars to come. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, David.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Have a great day.